Buzz on Business.
The Buzz on Business podcast is back. This is your place for everything happening here at the Spears School of Business on the beautiful campus of Oklahoma State University. I'm Stephen Howard, and I'm excited to introduce the Buzz on Business podcast family to Dean Jim Payne. He has crammed a whole lot into his first 8 months here on the job here in Stillwater. Not only have you been trying to get the lay of the land, but you've had AACSB accreditation and a ton of other adventures. Have you had a chance to catch your breath yet?
Pretty much. It's been pretty seamless here. The Spears faculty and staff have been quite welcoming the students, and the same can be said for the Stillwater community. So it's been a pretty easy transition for my wife and myself. And the past 7 months have been busy. We had our accreditation visit. We had to prepare for that, so that went well. We also worked on a strategic plan that we're going to be implementing this spring semester as well. And in addition to all that, it's been great getting on the road as well, meeting all of our alums and donors for the Spears School of Business. And they're very passionate and very dedicated to the school, which is it's very nice to see.
Well, you mentioned the strategic plan. Any goals or visions that you've kind of been able to mold in your time here so far?
My predecessor, Ken Eastman, did a great job with the undergraduate programs. And in terms of high-touch experiences students have with the faculty and staff, ranging from the Easton Center for Career Readiness and getting students prepared for life after Spears in terms of their career, as well as the Cagle Center, which focuses on study abroad opportunities for students to get them a global perspective.
Well, speaking of that research profile, let's chat about some research today, because we have some amazing faculty and staff, faculty who are doing research here at the Spears School of Business, and we want to hear it straight from them. So we've got a couple of folks in here today. Dr. Lisa Slevich joins us to talk all about authenticity in the craft brewing process, which is getting me excited for the Craft Beer Forum of Oklahoma coming up on April 6th. And we've also got Dr. Brian Edwards, who's joining us to talk about his latest paper on the supervisor bottom line mentality, what that is, what it does to an organization, and how to shake free from it. So, Dean Payne, you ready for your first Buzz on Business podcast?
I think we'd let it rip.
Let's go for it.
We're joined today by Dr. Lisa Slevich, Associate Professor and Spears Fellow in the School of Hospitality and Tourism Management of the Spears School of Business. Lisa has extensively researched the craft beer revolution taking place across the nation. We will chat about her recent work entitled Authenticity of the Craft Brewery Visitor Experience, a Scale Development Study, published in the Journal of Hospitality and Tourism Management. Since 1985, the number of craft breweries that have popped up nationally have massively outpaced macro breweries. Today, over 6,500 craft breweries exist in the U.S., including a handful right here in Stillwater, Oklahoma. This has turned the craft brew world into a distinct form of beer tourism, one that emphasizes tasting and learning and the overall experience of the visitor. Lisa, first off, thank you for joining us today. And secondly, it sounds like that you have picked the most fun topic to research possible. My question is, did you bring for us any beer today, or should I have made the beer run?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. Unfortunately, I did not bring any beer.
Okay.
It's an oversight on my
okay.
part.
That's all right. We'll mention later about the craft beer forum later in April here. But my first question is, one of the core concepts that separates the craft brewery experience from the big beer brands and authenticity. Lisa, tell us about what makes authenticity such an important and unique part of the craft beer and beer tourism.
I should probably go back to answer this question, I should go back to why we did the study. What we realized is that as we shift towards experiential, a transformational experiential economy, particularly in hospitality industry, we need to understand what is it that makes customers' experience special. And authenticity kind of plays a big role in it, because it makes us feel good, it creates unique experiences for customers, and it goes really well with craft brewery, because when we go to craft breweries, we expect to have those unique experiences. So our original idea was to identify, like, what is it that makes an authentic experience when we visit a craft brewery? But then we realized, like, oh, there is no way to measure it because there is no scale. So we kind of have to go back and develop basically a scale for measuring authenticity. But what it allows us to identify is to kind of see what dimensions of authenticity exist. So it's a different component. And to be honest, our study took us to like new directions, something that we didn't expect. But that's the beauty of doing research. You find something that, again, not necessarily is expected.
Most previous studies on craft brewing focus on the beer itself or as tourism motivation. Did your study examine the difference in the experience for locals and tourists? Did you find that they differed in their preferences or perceptions?
That was actually one of the surprises that we found out. There wasn't a different perception of authenticity between locals and visitors, and that was a surprising component. So it was a pretty consistent perception of what makes craft brewery experience authentic. And another surprise was it's not just beer. So one of the dimensions of authentic experience was related to the product. So people expect unique beers, they expect them to be of high quality, served in nice glasses. But there is also such dimension that we identified as authenticity of care. People also expected to have really good social interactions with the staff and other people in the craft brewery. So that social aspect was very important for them to kind of like experience an authentic craft brewery visit. And also the ambience, so authenticity of the ambience. People were looking for something that makes a particular brewery unique, like artwork, for example, or like other features that would set it aside from other craft breweries.
In part of the study, though, you created a universal scale for measuring that authenticity. Tell us about the scale and what set breweries apart.
Well, that scale has a number of items. That's like in scientific terms, and it has several dimensions that I mentioned. So we identified, like, for example, measures of different aspects of beer as a product, or different aspects of what staff is doing with regard to making a craft brewery experience authentic. Like, for example, are they welcoming? Are they making you feel like you're part of the family? So those kind of things. And the last component, ambience. So for example, are they using unique artwork? Is the ambience comfortable? Like, do you feel that this brewery is different from any other breweries? So those kind of things.
Okay, very good.
I don't want to be very scientific, so I'm just trying to give an example. Otherwise, I would say, like, our scale has 28 items that are measured on a 7-point Likert scale.
Yeah. I have a question. Did food come into play at all in the craft brewery experience? Did people expect food offerings and that sort of thing, or was it mainly about the culture that was in the brewery itself?
It was more about beer rather than food. So food didn't come up as an item in the core product. So it was mostly about beer, which, again, wasn't surprising. But again, the culture, the atmosphere were very big components too.
Well, what's next on the research agenda for you?
Well, we are still looking at the information we collected from that study. So we are also looking at the such concept as neo-localism. Like, what is it that makes people feel that this place is truly local? So authenticity is close to it, but this concept of neo-localism is relatively new, so we are also looking into that, trying to develop a scale for measuring it. We're almost done, so it's ready for publication. What I'm also doing right now is we're looking at, again, dining experiences, since I'm a hospitality and tourism professor, but we are looking at dining experiences from the perspective of equity and inclusion for people with dietary restrictions. So because, again, looking at the experiences for this particular group, it looks like they oftentimes do not have the same kind of experiences as people with no dietary restrictions. And they kind of been marginalized. So we would like to address it, so maybe bring it up to food service providers, to their attention, and like identify what can be done so people don't feel marginalized because they have gluten intolerance.
I'd love to know a little more about that new localism that you referred to. It. What type of industries did you explore in that? Was it restaurant, breweries?
That was just breweries. So at this point, it was just for craft breweries. But we see that it can be easily transferred to any kind of food service operations. Because again, when we go to restaurants, oftentimes we look for something that's local, different from anything else. It's not a chain. And that definitely can be applied to restaurants.
That's interesting. So you found this to be a phenomenon basically all over the country? Is that?
Absolutely. And again, I did it with colleagues from basically all over the United States. So we were in different parts of the United States. But to be honest, the findings were pretty consistent. So we didn't notice much difference between people, for example, Oklahoma and Missouri and California. So the authenticity, the neo-localism, those things still seem to be pretty relevant.
We're going to have to keep an eye on this for Discover Magazine for next year. That's got some potential there, doesn't it?
Yeah. Very interesting.
Well, I can talk about our research for ages.
Well, the topic is timely because, you know, as you know, on April 6th, we have the Oklahoma Craft Beer Forum.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the School of Hospitality and Tourism Management is putting on. So for those listeners that are interested, if you want to get tickets available for the event, you can look at type in business.okstate.edu or simply Google Craft Beer Forum of Oklahoma and they'll provide all the information you need.
And I strongly encourage everyone to participate. I was not a beer drinker until I started going to Craft Beer Forum, and I learned so much about beer. And though it's not my favorite drink, it definitely went up on my list of favorite things quite high.
I completely see how it would. I mean, we're talking about a room just full of amazing craft breweries from all over this region, both here in Stillwater, all the way down into Texas, and just amazing food pairings to go with it. And you learn about the science behind it and all that kind of cool stuff. I completely see how this could turn you into almost a researcher, right?
Yes, I didn't know that many beers exist, and there are so many subtle differences. And those craft breweries that are going to be presented, they are such wonderful people. They are passionate and they want you to learn and experience what they have. They are so proud of their product. You can feel it. So it's a wonderful event. I definitely, again, I am partial, but I encourage everyone to try it.
Well, thank you so much, Lisa, for taking time with us this morning, and good luck with the rest of your research.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
Our next guest is Dr. Brian Edwards, professor and Joe Sinar Chair in the Department of Management in the Spear School of Business. Brian's research runs the gamut of management organizational behavior. He has studied how people react to self-driving cars, how AI and automation can change the future of manufacturing, and today we're talking about ethical leadership and the supervisor bottom line mentality. Brian, thank you for taking time to join us today. Our topic explores your recent research entitled, Oh, the Anxiety, Supervisor Bottom Line Mentality and Mitigating Effects of Ethical Leadership, published in the Journal of Management. Some would say I have a bottom line mentality myself, especially with respect to finances, but I consider myself quite ethical and very transparent. Tell me about the bottom line mentality among supervisors and what it can do to a workplace.
Well, thank you, Dean Payne. I'm happy to. So, a supervisor bottom line mentality is one where a supervisor is singularly focused on some bottom line outcome. And for most of us, that's going to be money or productivity, and in most cases, it's both. I think this is important because, as you'll see in the news, there have been a lot of scandals lately where this is the impetus for unethical behavior. And this is what we focused on, was the unethical behavior by employees as a result of a supervisor's bottom line mentality. Some of the examples that I noted was the fact that Boeing ignored a lot of the advice from their engineers and put into production the 37 Max, and of course two crashed, and just recently they've had some rivets come off of one of the side panels in mid-flight. And so other examples are Wells Fargo employees opening up fraudulent accounts to make more money, and there's even one example I ran across of a hospital in New Jersey where they kept alive vegetative patients to extend, you know, the survival rates, which were tied to the bottom line at that hospital. So there are a lot of examples that you can probably come up with and think about where supervisor bottom line mentality leads to these outcomes for employees, because the supervisor is the one that provides sense making. The employees are looking to what's important, and if the bottom line is the only thing that's important, that's all that's being communicated, that's where they start to cross the line.
Previous research was one-dimensionally focused. In other words, it treated supervisors that have the bottom line mentality as if they're always in that mode. But your research found that that varies quite a bit from person to person and day to day. That reshapes the understanding of the construct. What made you think to investigate this further?
That came about because I do research in manufacturing, where there's often this perceived competing values framework between production and safety. And so there's this mentality that if I have to stop and do safety procedures like lockout and tag out and putting on a harness and things like that, it's going to slow down my productivity. And what we've learned in that research years ago was that you can have both. Like they're not competing. So you can be both highly productive and safety. And we did that because you instill a strong climate for safety where all of those behaviors become automatic and then productivity can pick up. I thought the same thing can happen here. There's no way we're going to tell managers not to have a bottom line mentality. I mean, that's just business. And so the key there is, why can't we have both a bottom line mentality and ethical leadership? And so we look to the extent to which leaders held a consistent ethical, and by ethical I mean moral character and moral behavior, a consistent ethical framework. And that mitigates the problems we're seeing with bottom line mentality. So in other words, you won't see sort of the unethical behavior if the leaders are still communicating ethics consistently, even if their bottom line mentality fluctuates on a day-to-day basis. That's one of the things we thought was, I don't think supervisors are always, you know, communicating a bottom line. I think it fluctuates daily, weekly. It depends on the demands of the job. And so what was happening, what we observed, was that when you fluctuate the bottom line mentality, that causes a lot of exhaustion, because then employees are like, okay, now I got to stop what I was doing and redirect my efforts to what the supervisor wants me to do today, right now. And it causes exhaustion, anxiety, and they start to undermine their coworkers. Ethical leadership and a consistent ethical leadership sends a message that this still is not acceptable. So we want the bottom line, but it has to be done in an ethical manner.
I wondered if in your research, what percentage of the groups that you looked at followed that ethical leadership? Was it the majority of them, in that these are outliers that had the issues that came to the forefront in the news?
That is true. Most people reported at least being ethical, or their employees did. So we're still talking about variability in that top end that helps to mitigate that. And it's what was really cool was we had supervisors rate their own what they perceived to be fluctuations in their own ethical leadership, and that didn't impact the employees that much. It was the employees' perceptions of the supervisor's behavior. So that was a key difference.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, thinking about the supervisors, but going up the food chain even further to who they're responsible for.
Yes.
And also board leadership and so forth. Any thoughts on that?
Yes. So we already have existing research that shows that ethical climates, ethical leadership is learned. It's trainable. I mean, we have training classes here in the Spear School of Business through the Center for Future Work, where we train ethical leadership, but it will only be sustainable if those in the higher upper echelons also share those same goals. And you see that not just with ethics, but in other things as well. We saw when we tried to build a strong safety climate in manufacturing, it had to go all the way to the top. When we did a high involvement leadership intervention several years ago at a hospital in Tulsa, the same thing. The CEO got involved in the training intervention, and it made a huge difference.
So what's next on the research horizon for you?
Well, I'm doing a lot of work now. Obviously, AI is the next biggest thing, and it is. I am interested in the extent to which artificial intelligence can be used to enhance the workplace, whether or not people are going to embrace it. So like with any new technology, it's going to replace jobs. But we've had technological innovations for centuries, and people still work. It just changes the nature of work. So I'm trying to understand what are the newest, latest, greatest jobs, and then how can we use and leverage AI to get people engaged in the workforce that haven't been before. So I would assume that right now, you know, we train people and we hire them based on a set of skills that they can bring to the job. AI can help to compensate for people who don't have those skills, or maybe they develop a new set of skills that are important to them. I mean, we have a lot of people that are big into gaming that don't have a college education, but they could run a computer or a robot quite well with the help and use of AI. I really want to see us get people with disabilities engaged in the workforce with the help of robotics and AI as well.
Yeah, maybe explain a little bit on that, because when I first came into Spears, we chatted about a large project you're involved with several other universities around manufacturing and servicing those that are labeled as disabled. So you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, we have a lot of people that are not in the workforce or not employed at jobs that they can possibly. So for instance, we have a lot of talent in Oklahoma, but we're a rural state. So you've got someone out in Woodward or in other areas of rural Oklahoma that might be able to engage in manufacturing, which is usually based around in and around Tulsa and Oklahoma City. How can we get them engaged distance? I mean, we've got robots that can do jobs, but we need some people to monitor and repair and operate these robots, so that might be able to do it. In terms of disabilities, we have a lot of robotics. You think of a robot, you think of one that looks like you see in Star Wars, but robotics can be put on your hands, skin, clothing, and they will serve, I think, as the next reasonable accommodation that we can make to employees to accommodate some physical or mental disabilities that they may have.
Is the implementation of this, the mental hurdle that the people have to make in order to accept this type of AI technology, is that going to be one of the biggest hurdles involved in this?
Absolutely, yes. Because they fear. They fear that it's going to take their job. And so you start to introduce AI into manufacturing, and there are lots of examples of sabotage. Where they run a forklift through a big multi-million dollar robot because their fear is going to take their job. There's also a sense of resistance because I think humans don't want to give up control. And so to the extent that you're operating a robot and giving up control, and we saw that in one of the dissertations that I just chaired, where there's a wide range of trust depending on what the AI is capable of doing. So for instance, there's a lot of resistance to AI driving cars, but there's a lot of data that suggests humans should not be driving cars. We're really bad at it. We should turn it over to AI, but there's a lot of resistance. You're going to see a lot of resistance to self-driving cars. People don't want to give up that level of control. That's why there's a fear of flying. There's this lack of control because you're just sitting in an airplane and someone else is doing all the driving for you.
Thank you, Brian, for taking time today and sharing with us your research. And I also want to thank Lisa for joining our podcast today as well.
Thank you very much for having me. Enjoyed it.
That about wraps things up for this episode of the Buzz on Business podcast. This episode set the bar pretty high, but we're excited to try and top it with a couple of special episodes this semester. We're going to dive into the business of sports with a very special guest. Stay tuned for that. But this year also marched the 10-year anniversary of a couple of amazing centers here within the Spear School of Business, the Easton Center for Career Readiness and the Kegel Center for Advanced Global Leadership and Engagement. They're kind of our secret weapons here for preparing students for that next step in their lives. But we're going to sit down with Joe Easton, the founder of ISN and the namesake of the Easton Center, to find out more about his initial vision for that center and how it's come to change the trajectories of thousands of OSU students. Don't forget to get your tickets to the Craft Beer Forum of Oklahoma, which is coming up on April 6th, right here in Stillwater. Until next time, we hope you've enjoyed the Buzz on Business podcast.